Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
I voted yes because right now, I mean, we need to fund the government.
The State House passes a budget that would pull nearly $600 million from savings. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, April 18th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, after adapting to fishing for more rockfish, charters will see new limits this summer.
Things are okay. We're just on an increasing harvest trend that is likely to lead to unsustainable levels.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Construction season is here, Alaska. Avoid surprises on the drive. Before getting on your way, check 511 for traffic delays. For current traffic information and road conditions, visit 511.alaska.gov or download the app or call 511. For more detailed information about DOT construction projects, visit dot.alaska.gov/construction. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities.
As the Alaska legislature enters the final 30 days of the session, the House approved an operating budget Monday that includes a $2,700 permanent fund dividend. The budget would also fund a one-time increase to the amount of money the state spends on each student in public schools, something districts around the state say is long overdue and necessary to cope with inflation. It's estimated the budget would force the state to pull nearly $600 million from its savings based on oil price projections. The bill passed along caucus lines with 23 members of the Republican-led majority voting for it. Representative Julie Colomb, a Republican from Anchorage, acknowledges the bill is not perfect, but says the legislature is working on ways to bring in new revenue, including some new tax proposals.
I'm not thrilled about having a deficit that much, but I'm encouraged that there's coming a fiscal plan that maybe next year we won't be in this situation again. But I voted yes because right now, I mean, we need to fund the government.
Members of the Democratic-led House Minority Caucus are critical of the bill. They say the PFD amount is too high considering the state's dire finances. And they say the one-time funding for K-12 students should be extended so that districts can plan better. Ketchikan Independent Dan Ortez voted against the bill. He says without high oil prices, the budget would require pulling more than a quarter of the savings left in the state's budget reserve.
We can't shift our major budget votes and long-term fiscal plan votes around day-to-day shifts, month-to-month shifts in the price of oil because as little as a month ago, it was not looking so good, and who knows what's going to happen in the future.
The budget now goes to the Senate, which has proposed a much lower PFD amount. The two chambers are hoping to come up with a compromise before the constitutionally mandated end of the session in about a month. Representatives say despite disagreements, the mood in the House is more cooperative than they've seen in the past few years. They say they're optimistic the legislature can find a compromise by the end of the session on May 17th. A man urging state lawmakers to take action against deep-sea trawling was removed from the state capitol in handcuffs and banned from the building after disrupting a committee hearing Monday. The Alaska Beacon reports that after his removal, former fisheries worker Eric Osuch went to the nearby state office building and was arrested by the Juneau Police Department after a fight was reported there. The department said he was charged with trespassing. Osuch was the first person forcibly expelled from the Capitol in 3 years. Though legislators frequently deal with contentious and emotional topics, protests are typically orderly and held outside the front doors. Jessica Geary, director of the agency that operates the Capitol, said no one has received a trespass notice barring them from the Capitol since 2020, and before that, the most recent incident was in 2016. On Monday afternoon, security officials were still finalizing the formal incident report. U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan seems to be shifting to the right, at least with his political messaging over the years. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin wrote about it Thursday in her newsletter, Alaska at Large, and she's here to talk about it. Liz, what have you noticed?
Well, what got my attention was his response to the news that former President Trump had been indicted. Sullivan responded in the same way that many Trump loyalists did by attacking the New York prosecutor who pursued the charge.
This is the statement that Sullivan issued before the indictment was released, right?
Right. And it was surprising to me because when Trump was president, Sullivan seemed more careful not to take sides. Reporters were always chasing down Republican senators to ask, what do you think of this thing that President Trump just said or did? And Sullivan would usually say he couldn't comment because he hadn't read the tweet or hadn't seen the interview for himself. He seemed back then to be trying to stay a plausible distance between himself and Trump while trying, you know, not to alienate Alaska Republicans who love Trump. And now, without knowing what the charges against Trump were, Sullivan was very comfortable calling it an abuse of law. It was also interesting that Senator Sullivan co-signed a letter to the Biden administration late last month criticizing identity-affirming care for transgender children. That's as reported by Riley Rogerson at ADN. So that was stepping into the culture wars in a way that appeals to far-right voters. It's not the kind of thing that the Dan Sullivan of 2014 would have done, you know, when he first ran for office.
So you detected a departure in his messaging, but is this shift something you can document or measure, like with his voting record?
Yeah, I made use of this tool that ProPublica has that allows a head-to-head comparison of voting records. And what really stood out is how much his record has diverged from Senator Lisa Murkowski's. So far this year, Sullivan and Murkowski have canceled each other's votes 62% of the time. In the previous Congress, they voted opposite 40% of the time. And before that, the two Republican senators disagreed only about 10% of the time. Part of the story here is that Murkowski is straying toward the left of her party more than she used to. And Sullivan is voting more in line with the median Senate Republican, and the party has shifted toward Trump.
Gotcha. Well, I was going to ask you what Senator Sullivan has to say about this, but I know from what you wrote in the newsletter that he hasn't done an interview with you.
Oh, yeah. It's been months and months since he's agreed to an interview with me. He rarely stops to talk to reporters in the hallways at the Capitol, and he usually blows right past me. But I can still report on what he does and what he says to others.
Okay. Well, better luck next time, Liz. That was Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin. She writes Alaska at Large, a perspective on Alaska news in the nation's capital. You can subscribe to that and any of our newsletters at alaskapublic.org/newsletters. And Liz, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Casey.
The state has released forecasts for this year's Yukon River salmon returns. Alaska Department of Fish and Game Yukon River summer season salmon manager Dina Jallin says the number of kings coming back is predicted to be more than last year's 50,000, which was the worst since run assessment projects began in 1995.
Our forecast is for a run between 62,000 to 104,000 fish, and below around 150,000, we don't tend to meet goals either in Alaska or Canada.
The Yukon River summer chum salmon forecast spans both sides of last year's return of 480,000, which was the fourth worst since 1995.
The forecast is between 280,000 to 900,000.
The drainage-wide summer chum low-end escapement goal is 500,000. Below escapement goal runs last year resulted in fishing closures for both kings and summer chums. Jallin says that will likely be the case again this year, at least for kings.
But for summer chum salmon, we're hoping that the run comes in strong and that ideally by the midpoint, it'll look like we're going to exceed the drainage-wide escapement goal and we'll hopefully be able to offer an opportunity with selective gear to go for summer chum salmon while releasing king salmon alive.
As far as the Yukon River fall chum return, the state is forecasting a run of between 112,000 and 602,000 fish. Last year's run was 242,000 fall chums, well below the lower end escapement goal of 300,000. And subsistence fishing remained closed. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Sea Alaska Heritage Institute's first winter intern gets deep into snow science.
You'll feel the different layers. There might be hard crusts, there might be soft layers, there might be wet layers.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health, but did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by SNAP.
South Central Alaska's avalanche season is not quite over yet. Two people were caught Saturday in late season avalanches, one near Hatcher Pass and the other in Turnagain Pass. Both survived, suffering minor injuries. Wendy Wagner, head of the Chugach National Forest's Avalanche Center, said the Turnagain slide swept a skier 2,000 feet downhill over rocky terrain at 40 miles per hour. The skier wore a helmet, and an avalanche airbag helped keep their head above the snow.
Larger items get pushed up, and so you're trying to make yourself as big as possible, and that's what these airbags help do.
Just hours later, a skier hitting a jump near Hatcher Pass triggered a slide that was caught on video by a parked snow machine rider. The skier was unhurt, but the snow machiner was swept 50 yards and buried in snow. He was dug out minutes later. Allie Barker with the Hatcher Pass Avalanche Center says recreators should try to avoid that situation. It's best to descend slopes one at a time so only one person is exposed to the risk of a slide.
Unfortunately, two people were exposing themselves at the same time, and so one was able to ski out while the other one was caught, carried, and buried.
Heavy winter snowfall has left South Central slopes prone to slab avalanches. Wagner says nobody in the region has been killed in a slide this season. At Hatcher Pass, Barker says she's seeing more educated visitors to the backcountry.
And so it seems like the work that we're doing is making a difference in saving lives.
Wagner says the heavy Chugach snowpack could persist into summer, posing a potential threat to hikers in areas like Crow and Powerline passes.
People don't understand the risk they're taking by going on the trail because it might seem nice and warm in the parking lot, but it could be quite dangerous.
Still, both the Hatcher Pass and Chugach Avalanche Centers are cutting back forecasts as the season winds down. The Army has sent 90 Stryker vehicles from Fort Wainwright to Ukraine to help the nation defend itself. And as KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, the fort still has a few Strykers around to help soldiers train to defend against attack with weapons of mass destruction.
The Army transferred 329 Strykers from Fort Wainwright to the Anniston Army Depot in Alabama last fall, then in January sent 90 of them to Ukraine as part of a military aid package.
Those are the ones that have been utilized to support the Ukrainian effort.
Ashley John is a spokesperson for the Army's Ground Combat Systems Program Executive Office, and she said in an email Monday that the Strykers sent overseas were, quote, part of the U.S. commitment to provide security assistance to Ukraine. In February, the U.S. sent about 30 Strykers to Bulgaria, a Balkan nation to the south of Ukraine. 11th Airborne Division Commander Major General Brian Eifler says the Stryker transfer to Ukraine was done after the Army decided last fall that the vehicles wouldn't fit with a division's directive to focus on defending the Arctic and training here.
That was a decision made at the Army level to divest of the Strykers and to work on a force that's more capable in the region and also training in that environment.
Eifler said in a news conference last month that the iconic multi-wheeled, lightly armored vehicles weren't suited for the division and its two newly reorganized brigades, an infantry unit based at Fort Wainwright and an airborne unit at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. But the Army decided to keep a few specially equipped Strykers here in Alaska.
Back in September, we divested ourselves of probably 99% of the Strykers that we had here at Fort Wainwright. However, one unit did keep a small handful of them.
Fort Wainwright spokesperson Eve Baker says that's the 17th Combat Sustainment Support Battalion. The unit specializes in training soldiers on how to respond to attacks involving chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear weapons.
So these Stryker vehicles have radiation detection equipment and protective abilities, and they're used Army-wide in this type of unit.
Baker says some of those Strykers and their crews took part in last month's Joint Pacific Multinational Readiness Center, or JPMRC, training exercise held on ranges around Fort Wainwright.
So people may see them and be confused, but we did divest ourselves of the vast majority of the Stryker vehicles.
Meanwhile, Army officials are trying to figure out what to do with the rest of the Strykers.
The Army is still considering several options on what they intend to do with the particular Strykers that came out of Alaska.
General Charles Flynn heads up the Army's Pacific Command, and both he and Eifler talked about Strykers and the JPMRC exercise during a March 30th news conference at Fort Wainwright.
Obviously, they need to be upgraded, but there's a wide range of options that are that the Headquarters Department of the Army is working their way through.
Army officials say the Stryker is a versatile platform that supports 18 variations that include vehicles equipped with armaments like mortars or cannons and others that transport soldiers and supplies and clear minefields. And Flynn says the Army has modernized some Strykers to accommodate short-range air defense and intelligence collection systems. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
Tourists are lured to the Kenai Peninsula every summer by the promise of big catches from the decks of saltwater fishing boats. But as regulations on halibut and king salmon fishing have ramped up in the last decade, charter guides have branched out into another species, rockfish. This year, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game is limiting rockfish harvest by emergency order to make sure the population doesn't plummet to the point of no return. KDLL's Sabine Pooks has more.
Mike Booz with the department's Division of Sportfish says the new bag limits for rockfish, announced Thursday, are preventative.
Things are okay. We're just on an increasing harvest trend that is likely to lead to unsustainable levels.
He traces that trend back in part to 2014, when the council that manages fishing in Alaska's federal waters passed a catch-sharing plan to allocate halibut harvest between commercial and sport fisheries. He says right away, charters started going more for rockfish. Meanwhile, the department has tightened regulations on king salmon fishing too, including closures and decreased bag limits. That's as king salmon across Alaska continue to suffer. Again, he says those restrictions have pushed saltwater charters to broaden their scope.
Within the day, they're spreading their effort among species.
Ray DeBartoleben owns Long Live the King's Lodge in Soldotna. He also has a saltwater boat out of Homer and will start taking clients out for the season later this month. He's been fishing since the 1980s, when he says it was possible to get a 200-pound halibut. He says he no longer targets the clientele that expects that sort of fishing.
That clientele is gone for me. So I've really just spent money on marketing and just got new clients that they pull up a halibut that's 25, 30 pounds and their first thing they say is, wow.
He says there's still days when he'll take clients out to fish for halibut alone, but he started focusing more on trips for halibut and rockfish over the last 7 years. Rockfish are found further offshore, as far as the Chugach Islands in Cook Inlet on the other side of Ketchumak Bay State Park. Recently, the total rockfish harvest in Cook Inlet saltwater skyrocketed to over 50,000 fish a year, according to Fish and Game. Booz says the species is susceptible to overharvest. They don't migrate much like salmon do. They stick to the spots they like, which makes them easier to catch.
Because we know right where they're going to be every day.
Rockfish are also slow to mature, and they live a long time. Boo says that makes it hard for them to bounce back, which has happened to rockfish fisheries in the lower 48. He says that's another reason to be conservative with the restrictions. The new bag limits are 3 a day in Cook Inlet, down from 5, and 3 in the Gulf Coast area, down from 4. Richie says fishermen in Cook Inlet are getting used to diversifying as regulations continue to shift. Still, he says it can be hard to adjust.
That kind of uncertainty, when it's your business and it's your job, it can be stressful.
DeBartoleben says another challenge for charters has been increased gas prices. Those prices last summer sometimes doubled the cost of fueling up for charters. While he's worried about the changes, he says he's optimistic that halibut and salmon are rebounding. And he says he thinks there's been a mentality shift.
I think the new mentality of fishermen, they just want to go fishing and have a good time. I've had to change my attitude on how much fish do I need, how much fish do I want. So I kind of try to pass that on to my customers, you know, the attitude of we're going to go out and we're going to have fun and we're going to catch some fish and we're going to go eat it.
He says clients want the experience of going out and catching fish, no matter the species. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing cargo transportation to 9 Alaska communities. NAC offers options including cargo charters to get freight where it needs to be. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Sexual violence affects nearly every household in America. If someone you love has experienced sexual assault or abuse, it can be a lot to handle. Reach out to the National Sexual Assault Hotline today to learn how to support someone you care about. Call 1-800-656-HOPE or visit rain.org. That's rain.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Denali National Park will be radio-collaring grizzly bears this spring as part of a project to assess impacts of park road traffic on the animals. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the radio-collaring work will close sections of the park road and adjacent lands to foot and bicycle traffic for several days in May and June.
The road into Denali National Park remains closed to vehicle traffic at Polychrome Pass due to a massive landslide. The roughly midpoint closure provides an opportunity to study how grizzly bears behave with and without vehicles around.
Because we've got a whole section of the road with no traffic.
Denali National Park wildlife biologist Pat Owen says the 3-year tracking project will also include a period of time after a bridge is constructed over the landslide, allowing vehicle traffic to resume west of Polychrome Pass. Owen says the plan is to radio collar and track the movements of about 18 bears, roughly split between areas east and west of the pass.
That will give us a really good idea of how much effect traffic is having, and ultimately give us some insight as to, you know, the current traffic levels on the road, you know, whether those are appropriate.
Owen says they will dart bears from a helicopter, then land to collar them. The operation areas, including portions of the park road, will be closed to visitor foot and bicycle traffic, starting on the east side of the pass, May 15th through the 19th.
The May area will start at the Teklinika Bridge and include all of the backcountry units on either side of the road all the way out to the top of Polychrome Pass. And then in June, we'll do basically the same thing all over again, starting on the 2nd of June, and we'll be catching bears from the 2nd through the 6th. And that closure will start pretty much just east of the slide at Polychrome there, and will extend west, just short of the Wonder Lake area.
Owen says it takes several hours for the bears to wake up from the tranquilizer drug, and the closures are there for safety reasons.
I don't want someone tripping over a recently immobilized bear if it's recovering out on the landscape. It's not safe for people. It's not safe for the bears.
Owen says the park has conducted bear research using radio collars in the past and that it is stressful for the animals, but she emphasizes the value of the resulting data in fulfilling the agency's responsibility to both protect wildlife and provide visitor access.
You know, I feel really good about the work that we're doing out there and what we're learning, and I think it's well worth it.
Owen says the radio collars will be replaced with ones with fresh batteries in 2025, and those collars will be programmed to automatically fall off the bears in 2026. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Sea Alaska Heritage Institute has offered summer internships for Alaska Native and Native American high school students interested in STEAM careers. That's science, technology, engineering, art, and math. But this year, the first winter internship is bringing one Juneau student who loves to ski out into avalanche terrain. KTOO's Anna Canny reports.
We got
The snow on the board, the water on the board, the snow height.
On a sunny day at the top of Mount Roberts, Mike Janes is working through a checklist.
Snow surface error.
He's an avalanche forecaster with Alaska Electric Light and Power. He pulls a new tool out of his backpack. Then he starts to snap the pieces together like a tent pole.
10. Sky's clear.
Then he hands it to Jocelyn Aranda Jackson.
Does this look good?
Yep, that looks good.
She's a senior at Juno Douglas High School, and she spends her study halls out here as SHI's first avalanche forecasting intern. The probe she's got is used to measure depth. She starts tapping into the snowpack.
The other thing she can tell when she's doing this is you'll feel the different layers. There might be hard crusts, there might be soft layers, there might be wet layers.
Then she hits a stubborn layer.
Give that another tap, I'm wondering. Yeah, keep going.
Suddenly, it plunges deeper until the whole thing is buried.
It keeps going.
That's all the way to the top.
SHI runs a bunch of summer science programming, and Aranda Jackson has done a few of their programs before.
It's funny because I did do the STEAM camp as well. And I was talking about how I really wanted to get, I'd rather be skiing. I'd just be like, I'd rather be skiing right now. And they're like, okay, Jocelyn. And then like the next camp came, I was like, I'd rather be skiing right now, guys. And then somebody came over and was like, hey, so you, I heard you like skiing. I was like, yeah.
Chance to ski on the job piqued her interest. She's been skiing at Eagle Crest since she was a kid, so she was always aware of avalanche danger. But what she didn't know is how much work goes into predicting them. It starts with a lot of data collection. She pulls a shovel out of her backpack and starts shoveling snow into a clear plastic tube on a spring. This measures mass.
When I first got out here, I didn't think it was so, like, covered in all these different types of measurements. I think that was the most surprising to me, that you can measure it in so many different ways. And then there's so many different tools that could help you predict the snow coverage and all that kind of stuff.
But this internship aims to go beyond data. One of the major goals is to help students find a way to pair their Indigenous perspectives with a strong identity as STEM professionals. That's where Ellen Bradley can help. She's a Tlingit climate scientist, and she shares Aranda Jackson's love of hitting the slopes. She's a semi-professional skier. Usually, she tags along in the field. Through the mentorship program, Bradley shares her personal experience as an Alaska Native scientist navigating a Western academic setting.
That's something that I definitely wish that I could have had access to before I went to college. I think it would have really helped me center myself more in my identity and the work that I do within STEM, and really feel like I had more of a sense of place.
In the fall, Aranda Jackson will head to the University of Montana. She plans to study glaciology. After all, it's a field that offers the chance for skiing, even in the summertime. In Juneau, I'm Anna Canny.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Lex Trinan and Anna Canny in Juneau, Liz Ruskin and Chris Clint in Anchorage, Dan Ross in Fairbanks, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, and Sabine Pooks in Kenai. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com.
And by
Alaska Air Cargo, serving the commerce and business needs of 20 Alaska communities, from Adak to Barrow to Ketchikan. More information at alaskacargo.com.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.